Tonight's topic is, and I understand, was given to be spoken about partnerships, shutfis. And Chazal tell us an amazing idea about human nature in the parasha of Hilchos Shutfis, partnerships. Generally speaking, when there is a dispute, a monetary dispute between parties, now one says you owe me money, the other one says I don't owe you money, one says that I did the work, well, the other one says I didn't do the work, whatever it should be, I cannot obligate the other party to make a shvua, to make an oath, unless I am very certain that he owes me the money. You have to be very sure of your claim. You may be wrong, but you have to be convinced personally that what you're saying is true. In the event you come and you say, he might owe me money, so he might not, and he has no obligation to make a shvuah. A questionable claim has no status in Bezdin, and you can't make the guy swear. There's one of the exceptions to that rule is by partnerships. If two people are partners, and one person has control of the money, for example, and the other person is doing work, or he's investing, whatever the case should be, the halacha is the one who has control of the money could be compelled to swear, even though the other person has no idea if any money was taken, if any money is missing. It's called shvuas hashotfin. One partner could make the other partner swear. Swear to me that you didn't steal any money. You think I stole money? I don't know. I have no idea what's going on. Maybe you took money. Now, why is that? Why by shutfin is this a distinction than all other monetary disputes? And the reason is, Chazal tell us, because when people are involved in a partnership, they feel, they're moira heter, that they're doing much more than the other party. I'm working all day and all he is there. He comes in once a day and he thinks he's got a guy. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to even the playing field, as it were. I'm going to take a little extra. It's human nature to feel that they're being taken advantage of, and therefore they're going to even the score by taking advantage of the other person, and therefore we can make the other person swear even on a taina shem, even on a questionable claim, with no basis. Because of this and other reasons, Chafetz Chaim, Chanu Levracha, was miyayitz people. He gave people advice. If you're going to open a business, do it yourself. If it's at all possible, don't take a partner. Because invariably, there are going to be the feeling that I'm doing more than him, he's doing less than me, and he owes me something. And it's partnerships invariably end off, they start off what we call the honeymoon, and they end off with the divorce, as we'll get to. But conceptually, if it's at all possible, I understand it's not always possible to engage in business without partners. But if it's at all possible, the Chafetz Chaim was encouraged people not to take partners. And Rabbanim until today are still of the same nature and as okay. Now, if there's no choice, you're going to have a partner. Now, there's really five parts, minimally, to the partnership, which need to be explained. No, we're not going to be spending an hour on each one, so we'll be out of here before 12 o'clock for sure. But best case scenario is when you're about to start a partnership, you go and you have a contract written which clearly delineates the rights and privileges, obligations of the partners. And the reason for that is because before you start the business, that's what we refer to as the honeymoon, and everybody is willing to give the other guy whatever it is. Just, he should be my partner. Yeah, we'll do that, we'll throw that in. Yeah, you can hire your sister to be the bookkeeper. And yeah, I'll work till 3 o'clock in the morning. Whatever it is. Whatever they make up verbally, they're willing to do. When they sit down to write a contract, suddenly they start realizing, well, am I really going to be obligating myself to that? And it's exceedingly important to put it in writing, because, and they say from Benjamin Franklin, that lenders have much longer memories than borrowers. So the same al derech zeh, when people engage or begin to go enter a partnership, they have all kinds of, they're very eager to make commitments, and afterwards they start forgetting exactly what the commitments were. So you have to write it down. But when you write it, if you don't write it down, there's going to be obligations and commitments which you're naturally going to be bound to, even if you didn't write it down. And then certainly if you spoke it out, you're bound, even if you didn't write it. Nonetheless, it helps good fences make good neighbors. Write it down. Also, very sound advice, don't write it yourself. I personally was involved, not personally for myself, but someone came to me. He wrote a partnership agreement with his friend, was his friend, and he was very eager the other guy should join him, become his partner. So he wrote the whole agreement himself, and he gave away the family business, basically. Yeah, and we'll do this, and we'll do that, and we'll do this. And he didn't obligate, in an even way, the other person obligations. And when he came to me after the fact with this paper that he signed, I said, you know, I wish I could help you, but you've already, you know, cooked your own goose. So it's important to write it down. It's important to have it at least looked at by a third party who has both parties' interest in mind. Now, the first thing, I'm going to delineate basically five sections of the partnership. What are the investments? What is going to be the division of profits? What's going to be the division of losses? I know you're all into business, nobody's losing any money, but you got to talk about that. You'd be amazed. People have these long agreements where they discuss how the profits will be divided, and they fought about it, and they negotiated 0.3%, 0.5% of your half, back and forth, but they never even addressed what's going to be if money is actually lost, because people don't think in those terms. Regardless of who owns the business, there also has to be a question of who's controlling the business. I might own it, and you're controlling it. Now, maybe the fact that I own it, I could depose you, and you'll no longer be controlling it, but as far as the operating agreement, who's going to be running the business on a day-to-day basis, and who's going to be in control of the business, which brings us to the final basic section, and that is the gerushin, or the dissolution of the partnership. Exactly what are the terms and what are the means by which a partnership is ended. So the first thing is, when we speak about investments, if someone's going to invest in a partnership, it's not, classically, we think of conventional investments in terms of dollars and cents, how much money you put in. But a partner could be a partner by virtue of the work that he does. He could be a partner by the virtue of the fact that he has connections, he knows the supplier, he's able to make the shidduch between the parties, and therefore the partnership could be defined based on whatever you brought to the table that's worth, that has value to the other partners, and by which they're willing to bind themselves to this partnership. So, Maisi Shahaya, true story. Maybe the names have been changed to protect the innocent. Some of the nuance, the minutia of the facts may be a little bit. But basically what happened was, there was a clothing store. A fairly successful clothing store. And we'll call him David. David was the manager of the clothing store. He was an employee. He was being paid salary. And he was a wonderful worker. And he ran the business impeccably for 15 years. After 15 years as an employee, he went to the boss, we shall call him Michael, and he said, "Mike, I love working for you. It's been a real big pleasure. But I'm going to be making chasana soon. I need to really make more. I have to have more of the pie. I'm going off on my own." So Michael tells him, "Listen, David, you are my trustworthy worker. I can't imagine running the business without you. What I'm going to do for you, something I wouldn't do for anybody else, I'm going to give you a quarter of the business." That's something else, a quarter of the business? For a quarter of the business, it's worth it for me to stay. And he continued working in the business expanded, they added another section to the store, and he was working from Alois HaShachar till Tzeis HaNeshama. It was Murray that he was working and working, because it was worth it for him, he was getting a quarter of the business. After 5 years, he goes back and he says, I really, really, really appreciate what good friends we are and how nice, how much it's been working out all these years. I'm finding it too much work and not enough compensation. So I decided time has come to move on to greener pastures. So Michael says, "David, you can't do this to me. You've been such a tzir ne'eman, such a perfect shliach. Please, stay. I'll give you half the business." Oh, half the business? Now we're talking. He goes back with a vengeance and he's working in the business. A month later, he comes back to Michael and he says, "Mike, I don't want to sound like a kofri toiva. I don't want to sound like I don't have a karaset toiv. But I realized I'm not getting any younger, and it's exhausting for me. And I really appreciate you gave me half the business. I decided I'm going to sell my half of the business. So Michael says, sell your half of the business? What, you're going to bring in some stranger to be my partner? I don't want some stranger. No, don't worry. I researched the matter. I found out the business is worth approximately $1 million. So I figure my half is worth around $500,000. I'll sell you my half for $500,000. I really appreciate what you did for me. So Michael says to him, I only gave you half the business because I thought you were going to keep on working. And now you're walking out of me. So another year, another 5 years, 20 years, I should be in the wheelchair. I mean, how exactly is it going to work? When do I get my half of the business? And the guy says, I don't know. When besides, we never wrote a contract. Okay, so off to the Rav, they asked the Shaila. They went to the Rav, and the Rav said, well, first of all, the fact that they didn't write a contract is irrelevant. Because we have a principle in Hilchos Schiras Payalim, when you hire a worker, that the very fact that he does work, that creates a kinyan. And if the agreement was that in compensation for your work, you're going to get a quarter of the business or half the business or whatever it should be, then as soon as he goes to work, he gets his kinyan, whatever it is. However, the Rav said, it would seem to me, although nothing was written, great idea, nothing was written, and they didn't really elaborate on what the agreement was, but it would seem as follows. Let's say, for example, there was a building which was worth $250,000. And there was inventory was worth $250,000. So do you really believe that as a signing bonus for him agreeing to become his, to continue to go back to work tomorrow, he's giving him a gift of equity of $250,000? Doesn't make sense. What he meant to say was, but again, this is the koyach of a rov to be able to reconstruct from thin air exactly what the agreement and what the parties meant, because the parties themselves didn't know what they meant. But the idea is as follows. He's not giving him an actual kinyan in the bricks and the mortar and in the suits. What he's giving him, a salary based on half of the profits. The business will now generate $150,000 a year. You're going to get $75,000 of profit. You're going to get $75,000 of profit. But he never meant to give him the actual bricks and mortar. But again, that was the Rav's call. Makes sense. But what will be is, what if there were losses, like we spoke about before? So if I'm a partner for the profits, is that also part of my salary? Probably not. If I'm actually becoming a partner, so then maybe he actually gave him partnership in the gains and in the losses. Okay, so first idea is that there are investments which create the shotfis, exactly what has to be done, the ritual actions. So that's beyond the scope. Today it's assumed we write a contract that creates a kinyan. If the partners start working for each other, the Ramban says in Shulchan Aruch Paskins, that will also create, once I start working for the partnership, we become partners. If we actually pick up the money, the Rambam says you put the money in a box, and they both pick up the money, and that way they're both coming at each other's money, and they become partners. But regardless, we have a partnership, and now, after they become partners, the question is, how do we divide the profits? Let's assume that, for argument's sake, we could agree how much money each person brought to the table. One person physically brought $500,000, and the other person brought goods and services, whether he brought a building, or he worked, or whatever it should be. We're going to evaluate his investment to the business at $250,000. So one guy gave $500,000, one guy gave $250,000, and they did not write an agreement of how we're going to divide the profits. So one guy gave twice as much as the other one. So it would seem clear to me that if I give twice as much money, I should get twice as much profit. And the corollary to that would be, if I gave twice as much money and there's losses, I should lose twice as much money. That would be what would seem from the outside. However, the Gemara in Ksuvas, Tzadik Gimel, Amud Aleph, brings Shmuel. And Shmuel says as follows, Shnayim shehitilu lekis. Two people invested in a venture, and there's profits. So they divide the profits evenly, 50-50. There's a tremendous machlokes rishonim what the reason for this is, and there's a long nesivus that goes on for pages and pages depending on your print. Exactly, what's the rationale that we should divide the profits 50-50? Rashi says a svara. Let's say, for example, we both invested in a racehorse. And the racehorse cost $10,000, and I put up $9,000, and you put up $1,000. We couldn't have bought this racehorse without $10,000. So my $1,000 was just as essential for the purchase as your $1,000. Now, according to that rationale, let's say we were investing in widgets, and each widget costs $1. And we bought 10,000 widgets, and I put up 9,000, you put up 1,000, so that would be irrelevant. I could very well have bought 9,000 widgets without your $1,000 investment, and therefore it would be prorated according to the amount of your investment. But that's the rationale that Rashi gives, and it may have its place of when it will apply and when it won't apply. The Rosh brings Yerushalmi, who says that the basis for this halacha is, naturally, people assume that if they're getting involved in a partnership, they're going to be sharing the profits evenly, unless spoken out otherwise. It needed to be stipulated. And if it wasn't stipulated, then you understood that you better not open your mouth and tell me you're giving me less profits than I'm going to get. Why? Because you know that I'm better at business than you. I'm better at math than you. I'm better at whatever it is. There, I have some mile that you don't have, and you want me to be your partner. So if you wanted that the partnership should be any different than 50-50, you should have spoken out. If you didn't speak out, then it means you're acquiescing that we should split it evenly 50-50. That is the basis of the Rosh. Again, there may be halachic nafkaminas, what the reason is, but this is codified in Shulchan Aruch that unless there is a partnership agreement that specifies how the profits will be divided differently, it's going to be a 50-50 division. Now, the next chelik of this is a major problem that people in business probably on a daily basis make this mistake. I personally had people coming to me and I couldn't help them. What is it? People make an investment in a business. And they say, okay, they're going to be a silent partner, for example, but they want to have, let's say, 10% of the business. Actually, it happened, the guy, Robert Starr, he's giving $50,000. For his $50,000, he wants 10% of the action. But in addition, he wanted that his principal will be guaranteed. He's going to be getting back his $50,000. And in addition, he wanted 10% interest on his money. Now, we all know that you're not allowed to charge interest. I mean, that's Shulchan Aruch 101. You can't charge interest. You can't take. But we all know that there's a Nevaldik Skula, you know, where I'm Segulos. There's a Skula to ward off the evil Ribbis. It's called Heter Iska. So we'll write a Heter Iska, and they wrote, but all this money, they wrote, this, and then all this money shall be given, I'll be Heter Iska, Tam Ben Ishlam, Hakol Shri Vikayam, beautiful, we wrote a Heter Iska, now everything is Mutter. It doesn't go like that. Because the concept of Heter Iska is a very specific business deal, and if it's going to be a Heter Iska business deal, it's mutually exclusive from being an investment that you're going to have a chelik of the business, as we'll explain. What is this monster or this medicine called Heter Iska? The concept is very simple. I'm sure you're all somewhat familiar with it. We're just going to quickly go over the basic idea. And the idea is as follows. Let's say I have a business I need it funded. And you have $100,000. So we have a good shidduch, you're going to give me $100,000, and I'm going to now have money to invest in my business. Shidduch problem, you would like, we're going to use just for an example, 10%. You'd like 10% on your money. But we know the Torah prohibits ribbis. So the Chachamim came up with the following plan. You're going to give me $100,000, and we're going to divide it, basically, this is usually how it's done, what's called palga milva, palga pikad. Half of this $100,000, $50,000 is going to be a loan. A bona fide loan, and come fire or water, I'm going to paying you back this $50,000. I took a loan and I need that loan to fund my business. The other $50,000, you're investing in this business. So, let's say, for example, we go and we invest in horses, and the horses remain the same, and there's no change. 5 years, we invested in horses, we paid $100,000 to buy horses, we sold them for $100,000, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So, I give you back the $50,000 that you lent me, I give you $50,000 that you invested, and we're back at square one. But let's say it makes money. Kavali. So we do as follows. Let's say the $100,000 went up to $150,000. The price of horses went skyrocketing. And now we each get, so there was $50,000 profit. So we say as follows. The $50,000 that you lend me alone, I give it back to you. $50,000 that you invested, it grew. It grew $25,000 because each half grew, the total 100 grew 50. So you get back your investment and your loan plus $25,000. It's a win-win situation, and I made $25,000. Let's say Chalila, it lost money. The $100,000 worth of horses went down to $50,000. So there's a loss here. So this is a little bit tricky. But who lost this 50? The answer is we both lost. We each lost $25,000. So therefore, I have to give you back your $50,000 that you lent me as a loan, and the other $50,000 that you invested. I'm sorry, you lost 25, so you only get back $75,000. So that's a regular iska. It's a regular investment. What's the heter of the heter iska? So where's the beef, like they say? So the answer is as follows. We make a condition in this business agreement as follows. Even though the what we call him, the misasik, the managing partner, has the right to make bring aidim that there was actually a loss. Brings aidim that there was a loss and the discussion. Or he can make a shvua as how much the profits were. In which case the profits will be divided according to what his words are. And the losses will be divided according to the aid. Let's say the misasik, the managing partner, is unable to find aidim. He can't find aidim that there were losses, but he can't prove it. Alternately, he's a yarishemayim, and he doesn't want to swear. He's scared to make a shvua. So he has the option of either bringing aidim or making a shvua, or at his own volition, he could decide, you know what I'm going to do? I am going to just make a negotiated settlement. I'm going to give you 20% on the half that's an investment, which miraculously comes out to be 10% on the whole amount, right? Because I can't give you any interest, any profits on your loan, but on the half that's an investment, I'm going to be giving you 20% as a negotiated settlement, and we'll call it even, and with that, you'll be meichel the shvua, and you'll be meichel the edim, and we'll call it even. That's called heter iska. So this is a heter the Chachamim came up with, and it's a bona fide means by which you could lend money and be somewhat, feel somewhat safe that the other guy is going to not make a shvua. Most people don't like making shvuas, and most people have a difficult time bringing edim to exactly what went down in the business, and thereby you're going to get your 10% on your money. However, there's a problem. If I'm giving you this money because I want to buy half the business in reality, or a quarter of the business, or whatever it is, we can't simultaneously be an investor in the business on the one hand where I own half the business and simultaneously be a misasik with the din of heter iska. They're mutually exclusive concepts. Either you are getting your piece of the action as the heter iska based on this agreement which we just said that we're splitting the profits 50-50 and you can make a negotiated settlement based on the fact that I don't want to swear. Or you could give the money like a tatala, you bought a chelik of the business, and things go up, you go up, things go down, you go down. You can't have both ways. That's one thing. The second problem is, many people, when they write the heter iska, even without this, they want that the principal should be guaranteed. They want a personal guarantee on the principal. You can't do that. Because if there's a guarantee on the principal, then there's no risk. And the definition of an investment is, the definition of my money means that if it gets lost, I lose. If you lose, that means it's your money. We define ownership as who stands to lose if the money is lost. So if I'm going to say that the money is personally guaranteed, or the principal is going to be guaranteed, then that's a direct contradiction to the concept of heter iska, and it will not work. So when you make your partnership agreement, you should be careful to have it at least eyeballed by a competent rav who knows something about ribis. It shouldn't end up, you'll end up, you know, you spent many thousands of dollars drafting the agreement by lawyers, and it may stand up in a court of law, but in Beis Din, it won't have hands or feet. Now, the next point is that, like we said, in the event that there are losses, so the same way we said that when you have a investment, the investment is, even though one person gives more money, one person gives less money, the profits are divided 50-50, they're not divided prorated. The losses are also the same way. Unless, again, unless you specifically negotiated in the contract, otherwise, that's what's going to be in the loss column. Now, there's an exception to this general principle, and that is as follows. There is a machlokes rishonim in between the Rambam and the Ramah, which is, goes as follows. Let's say, for argument's sake, we have a partnership, and I invested $100,000 into the partnership, you put in $10,000. Right, so we said, okay, we're dividing the, if there are losses, we divide the losses evenly. Says the Ramah, if I only put up $10,000, I'm a minor investor, I can't have more exposure than the amount of money that I invested. I invested $10,000, that's the extent, that's the, there's a limitation on my exposure. You, on the other hand, put in $100,000, so if they're a commercial, if $40,000 is lost, so we're going to say, let's try to do numbers that work, let's say 120, say I put in 20, you put in 100, and $60,000 is lost. Okay, so if $60,000 is lost, so really we should be dividing the loss 50-50. I should lose 30 and you should lose 30. Problem is that I only put in 20. So the Ramah says, since I have a cap on how much money I invested, I only put in $20,000. That's it. I'm not further. I have no further liability, no further exposure.
But are you out?
What's this?
But are you out?
At the point at which, well, we're assuming that we've ended the partnership, we sold out,
and I understand and you, that, but you understand the question I'm asking.
You're asking me that once...
Are you out at that point?
Let's say the business
continues. Are you out at this point tomorrow? Not even money tomorrow. Let's say there's another $40,000 still left in the business.
So,
and the partner's still running the business. So the fact is you lost, you're out, have a great day.
That has to do with the conclusion of the partnership, which is really the
so
last section.
Is this an automatic conclusion of the partnership?
It would probably be an automatic conclusion unless the guy says, no, I'm coming up with cash. He can make a cash call and he can say, listen, either you put up or you're out.
Or you're out.
I would tend to agree with you.
Okay, that's
fair as fair. Now, there may be exceptions if we have again, if there's an agreement, if there's an agreement, if there's agreement otherwise, it wouldn't be that way. Now,
what I'm talking about without.
Yes, here's the what comes up though. One person put in much more money than the other one, so we have a machlokes between the Rambam. The Rambam says it's not true. You only put up 20, you're going to have to put up another 10 now. No such thing. You don't get automatically. We're not going to just like the Rambam. We're going to wipe the guy out. Like the Rambam, you're still in. So the problem is that the Shulchan Aruch in one place seems to say like the Ramah, in Hilchos Shutvim Kuf Ayin Vav, I believe he seems to say like the Ramah, that you have a limited liability. And in Siman, I think it's Tzadik Gimel, he seems to say like the Rambam, that the person who claims that there's greater losses, he has to make a shvua that how much the losses were. It would seem that he's going to be able to compensate himself from the other guy, connected the losses. So the Shach and the Bach both give, there's different terutzim in the Paiskim. The Shach and the Bach both learn that the distinction is a distinction. It depends what type of losses we're dealing with. If we're dealing with losses from the actual investment, right? We bought horses, or we bought stocks and the stocks went down. So an unexpected loss which was built into the business. So then they're going to have to split the losses evenly. Whereas if the losses were mimokah machet, there's a fire, which had nothing to do with the business per se. It was a fire, it was a geneva. So then, it's only going to be the person who put in the money, he's going to have the liability. That's how the Shach and the Bach both want to say. The Chasam Sofer and Shuvis, Sima Kufnu and Vav, also, he agrees with the Shach and the Bach's Teretz, because otherwise, Shulchan Aruch is a problem. So it would come out that under certain conditions, if it's a unusual cause, we're not going to hold the minor investor responsible for all losses. However, there is an Aruch HaShulchan. And the Aruch HaShulchan makes the following caveat. He makes the following. He says, this all depends on the nature of the business. If the parties who are investing are only investing the capital that's in front of them, so yeah, there's a limit on the investment, and there's a limit on the exposure. I gave less money. I only have exposure up to the extent of my investment. But in the event that we're anyways not spending capital, we're borrowing. We're going on credit. It's on, the business is being run on credit. So the fact that you only put in 20, but the business is borrowing $1 million. So let's put it that way. Let's say I put in 100, you put in 20, and the business borrows $300,000. So why should I have more exposure than you do? Because you gave 100,000. The bottom line is we were both relying on credit. And therefore, under such conditions, the Aruch HaShulchan says that even the Ramah is going to be moda that they're going to have even liability. Now, I'm sorry?
That's the problem, is that the credit got pulled.
No, but once the credit got pulled, they have to cover the loss. They have to cover the loss.
Again, they cover the loss.
No, but they're both borrowed.
But the shaman is, who's... We're closing up shop. Now, who's responsible? Like, who's being taken to the cleaners now?
No, but they both borrowed the money. That's not a question.
Right. Well, that's... if they're both... They both borrowed the money if it's on both of their names. But
again, it's the business.
Halachically, you're saying they both borrowed the money.
Right. The money.
Correct. Halachically, we view it, they both borrowed the money, regardless of who's on the paperwork.
But you're talking
now
about more money than you're forgetting. There's more money than both of them borrowing money. So there's more money in the pot than
either of them put in.
Than the original.
But in the event that, or let's say they both put money in the pot and they didn't even spend that money yet. They just borrowed money from somewhere else. So they're both going to be responsible for that. Now, again, we mentioned there should be an operating agreement. If there isn't an operating agreement, it's going to be very bitter, because anyone who's ever run a business knows that I have all the better ideas than you do, and you think you have all the better ideas than me, and it's the worst when there are only two partners, because it's one against one, and all bedlam breaks loose, because so they agree that we'll go to a third party, and then they start fighting who the third party is going to be. So everything should be clearly delineated, how it's going to, if there's a dispute, how we're going to deal with a difference of opinion on a day-to-day basis or on a general basis. Now, when you write a partnership agreement, once heard from a businessman, I was talking to him about, okay, we have to write the partnership agreement. Oh, you mean you want to write the gerushin? You want to write the divorce agreement? Why? Because when you get involved in a partnership, there has to be an exit strategy. If there's no exit strategy, all is lost. What do I mean that all is lost? Conceptually, Avad Chazal recognized the fact that two people are not going to, just because they put money in a pot together, does not make them marry to each other forever, till death do we part. That's not the way it's going to be. People, in the course of human events, people have disagreements, and they must sever this relationship one way or another. We're not going to be bound to this person ad infinitum. So what do we do? So Chazal gave us two basic methods of chalukah. The first method, they said, is called chalukah, split the pot. Now, it's very easy when you're dealing with a field that's 100 by 200. We'll each get a field of 100 by 100, and we'll walk away. It's called yesh bo din chalukah. It's evenly divisible. But let's say you're dealing with a house, right? There's a famous celebrated case in New York where the husband and the wife, they were partners in a house. And the question was, they couldn't get along. So how should we... And neither one wanted to give the other one the house and pay and compensate them for cash. So the judge said, build a wall! Split the house in half! Now, it's not... Besides that, you can't live with somebody in the same house when you're having a civil war with them. But besides that, you know, the heating is in one part of the building, the air conditioning is in the other part of the building. It's called Ein Bo Din Chalukah. It's not normal, and it's not feasible to make a division. And let's say we're partners in a horse. So what will we do? We'll cut the horse laterally, vertically, horizontally. How exactly are we going to cut the horse in half? If the principle is going to be... it's going to be lost. We're going to lose principle by the virtue of the fact that we're splitting it. We can't do that. So Chazal came up with another Eitzah. And that Eitzah is called Gud or Ogud. And the brilliance of Gud or Ogud is amazing. They don't even have skama. What is as follows? Me and you are partnership. We have a partnership in a major building. And this building can't be divided because there's seven stories and there's no way to divide it, and divide it this way, divide it that way. It's not going to happen. So I go to you as follows, and I say, I believe that this seven-story building is worth $1.2 million. That's what I believe. You may think it's worth more, you may think it's worth less, but I want out of here. I don't want to be your partner anymore. So I'm going to present to you with the following option. You could give me $0.6 million and I'm out of here. I'll give it to you. Alternately, you can give me, I can give you $0.6 million and you'll be out of here. In other words, I'll give you the choice. You want to buy me out or I'll buy you out. But I have to be the one to set the price and I have to be the one to give you the choice. Now, the reason this is brilliant is because anyone who ever played Monopoly, you know, they all know that, okay, I'll give you Marvin Gardens if you give me North Carolina. I say, well, would you do it the other way? Right? Is it worth it for you if we switch the deal backwards? Excuse me for using these. But in other words, I'm telling you, I believe the business is worth $1.2 million. You think it's worth more? So grab it. Give me 0.6 and get me out of here because you think it's worth $3 million. Get out. You think it's worth much less? So then, again, you should grab the deal and you should sell it to me for points. You should sell it to me for $0.6 million because you think it's only worth 0.3. Great idea. So I have to be the one to set the price and then I give you the option to choose which one you want. Now, the problem arises, it doesn't always work. The reason it doesn't always work is for three reasons. First of all, we had a situation where neither party was confident enough in the business to buy the other party out. It was a business that was based on Medicaid, and it was a Medicaid-based business, and it was during the Clinton era, and he was talking about cutting Medicaid drastically. But each party was earning $100,000 a month, the two partners. So they didn't want to buy the other party out because they didn't know if it's worth anything. But they couldn't let go because they're a tremendous cash cow. So neither party would budge. Didn't end in a happy ending, the whole story. But so it doesn't always work because not everybody's always willing to buy and sell. A. B, sometimes it happens, like it shouldn't happen. A guy puts forward the good or ugly offer, and when the other guy says, okay, I'll buy you out, he says, never mind. So when the good or ugly offer is tender, it has to be done under the auspices of a Beis Din where they make the parties sign in a fashion that there's no backseas. Once you've committed yourself, you're not going to just rescind on your offer. Number two. The third thing is, if you could just imagine for a moment, the World Trade Center, Olam Shalom, when it was standing. So they have a building, I don't have no idea what that building is worth. Let's say there were two partners, Silverman and Goldberg, for example. And Silverman was well off, and Goldberg was a schlepper. I don't know, he had a few million dollars to his name. The other guy was a multimillionaire. So he says to him, you know what? This building, I'm going to give you $4 million for your half of the building. It's a joke. It's worth many, 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 many millions of dollars. But I can't afford it. So the concept is by Oni the Ushir, the usher cannot turn to the Oni and say, go to Ogud. So what do you do in the situation when you can't do go to Ogud? So what you do is, you make sure beforehand to write a good, solid partnership agreement which describes what the method, what the exit strategy will be. We could say we're going to make a haluka in spite of all sense. We could agree that we're going to make a good or all good and that's what we're bound to. We could say that we're going to have a third party evaluator and one party could sell on the open market he sell the entire business. And then if you don't want it, you'll buy it. Right? There could be all sorts of exit strategies. But they have to be discussed by the parties prior to, while they're still in the honeymoon, so the parties will both agree to do it in a fashion and they have to sign on it. The last nekuda that's very important to incorporate in any partnership agreement, and that is, or in any agreement for that matter, is a dispute resolution. Because after all the great contracts and all the wonderful shtaris and all the agreements and I agree to this and you agree to that, what happens is one party breaches his side of the agreement and the other party says, you're in breach, and he says, you're in breach, and the question is, this is a material breach. Not all breaches are created equal. Some breaches are, okay, so I'll compensate you. Other breaches nullify the contract. So how do we decide? And who has to pay who, what, when, where? So what we do is, you have to go to Beis Din. Because, as you know, Jews can't just arbitrate the disputes in court. They have to attempt, al pi Shulchan Aruch, to go to a Beis Din. Now the question arises, let's say your good friend who you thought was the most trustworthy person in the world, after being in business with him for 5 years, you found out he's not such a trustworthy person. So you call him up and you say, let's go to a Rav. And he says, Rav, Shmav, I don't know you. you never gave me the money, you cheated me all these years, now you want to go to a Rav, I'll meet you in court. So he says, okay, so you send him a hazmana to Beis Din. And anybody who's been in the Beis Din process is familiar that unfortunately there are people who abuse the process and they play games and they say they want to go to this Beis Din and they want to go to that Beis Din, and when you show up, they don't show up, and they say they're coming next week and they're coming next year, and then they decide they want to go to a third Beis Din, and then they decide they want to go to Zabla, each one pick a Dayan, and then they don't show up. These things could be a protracted, they call it in Yiddish, Verschleppte Krank. It could be and often people lose their faith in humanity, and they lose their faith in themselves, and they just get so torn, and it's almost not worth it.
How can a business? Why have the business about the Adina Mavol allowed it to escalate to such a terrible thing?
Wonderful
How
question.
Did they do that?
So I could answer that question if you have an extra 20 minutes, but I'm just going to try to answer you in a. I'm going to give a short synopsis of the concept of Beis Din, and you'll understand what it is. I can give you the short form, I give you the long form. The short form is the courts of America are recognized by the government, federal courts, state courts, and they're empowered, and they have a police force and sheriffs who could enforce their rulings. The only power that a Beis Din has in America, according to legal law, the only power they have legally, is based on the fact that it's an arbitration panel, which the parties signed an arbitration agreement. So the moment that you sign that arbitration agreement, you're bound to what the arbitration panel signed, rules. Until you sign that piece of paper, the Beis Din technically, legally, has no power. Legally, they have no power. And if you are going to harass them and say that you must come to Beis Din, you're angling, perhaps, for a harassment suit. So Beis Din technically only gets their power from a legal standpoint once you sign that arbitration agreement. Even after you sign the arbitration agreement, and even after Beis Din paskins, we still have to, we don't have a police force to enforce it. We have to send the party, after he wins the judgment, we have to send him to court to approve the ruling. Now, generally speaking, the courts will rubber stamp the agreement. We'll rubber stamp the a story. A guy came to the judge and he said, "The Beis Din, they forgot to repeat Eger." True story. "They forgot to repeat Eger." And the judge looked at him and says, "Did you sign this arbitration agreement?" He says, "Yes." "Take it up with the rabbis. I don't know what you want." And he sent him on his way, you know. But so that's the first thing that you have to understand. Beis Din technically, legally, has no power until you sign the arbitration agreement. Second thing is, and this is also very important to know, I told you it's I'm trying to be mikatze, but in Europe, when things were all wonderful and great, there was a concept called a Beis Din Kavua Shebe'ir, which meant that when it was an organized kehillah, that's prior to World War I, there was an organized kehillah which had, they were recognized by the government that there is a kehillah, and this kehillah would then vote who should be the Rav and who should be the Zayin Tuvi HaYir, what's the alderman of the city who ran the Jewish council, as it were, and they also appointed a Beis Din. That Beis Din had the power to pick up in Cherem until Napoleon banned it. But until the Beis Din had the koyach to put people in cherem, they had the koyach to punish people, to flog people, to actually put people in stocks, they had power. Okay? Now, one of the powers that Beis Din had, if we're not getting so drastic, was they could demand that you came to their Beis Din. "We are the Beis Din Kavua. We are the appointed Beis Din of the city. You must come to us, or you're going to be ostracized. You'll be out of the community. You won't come. You won't get an aliyah. We won't mal your children. We won't bury you if you die." Beis Din had that koyach. Okay? After the disbandment of the communities, so there is no such thing as a Beis Din Kavua in a city, kimat. Maybe if you're from Bobov, and the Bobov have their own Beis Din, so then if you want to be part of Bobov, you have to come to their Beis Din. But with the exclusion of very specific instances in Flatbush. Who is the Beis Din in Flatbush? Well, three Rabbanim who know Shulchan Aruch get together, they say, "We're a Beis Din." Right? They don't have a koyach per se to demand that you come to them for a din tayr. They could demand Al pi Shulchan Aruch, that you go to Beis Din. But who that Beis Din is and where that Beis Din is going to be, that's omen for a lot of, there's a lot of wiggle room there. And that's why the system, by its nature, allows itself to be manipulated. Not that the Rabbanim want it to be this way. Listen, if I had, if I were
the
king,
allowed it to stagnate to this level.
If I were king of the world, if I were king of the world, I would say everybody has to get together now. Everybody in Flatbush has to get together, and they have to appoint Rabbanim, who will then appoint the Beis Din, and this Beis Din will be have the final word, and what they say is going to go, and anything that they say, and you can't start off. But until the Messiah comes, I'm not the king of the world, until Mashiach comes, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to accomplish. I'll grant you, if you move to a small community like Pittsburgh, or you move to a small community and there's only five shuls, so the Rabbonim and the Shtat could get together, they could get the power, and they could appoint the Beis Din. Could
move to California.
What's this?
Then he moves to California.
The guy will move to California. I understand. There's a lot of wiggle room over there. Okay, so, but, and here's the last point. When you write the arbitration agreement, if you stipulate that we will go to Beis Din X, so then the amount of wiggle room has been mitigated greatly. Why? Because even though he could say, well, take me to Beis Din, then I have to follow this agreement to begin with. Okay, so we'll go to the Beis Din. And which Beis Din I want to go to? I want to go to the Beis Din in Australia. But so there's wiggle room, but at a certain point, when the Beis Din, who is written in the agreement, sends the person a hazmana, and the person refuses to show his face, and he says, I want to go somewhere else. What the Beis Din generally will do, will permit the party to go to court, and in court, the court will enforce that you have to go to the Beis Din that's written in the agreement. And once they'll go to the balance written in the agreement, then hopefully seder will be made and things will be made. I thank you all for. If any more questions, and welcome to. We're glad to hear. Yes?
The question, Rivers. Does it have to be. The case you gave us 50-50. Let's say the side, okay, we'll make everything 99 and 1, and the 1 is going to be the return of the.
Okay, so let's talk about it in real numbers, okay? You're going to give. You don't want to have such exposure that it's going to be half. Milva and half Bikotin. Some people do Kula Bikotin. There's no loan here. It's all an investment, right? Or they say, how do you want to do it? You want to make a greater amount the loan or a greater amount the investment? Either way, there's an upside and a downside. For example, let's say we're going to say the investment part is much greater and the loan is much smaller. So then you have much more exposure, because it's, let's say 75% is an investment. So in the event that the investment goes down, I could bring Adim to that effect, and you lose 75% of your investment. On the other hand, let's say we're going to make a greater part is going to be the loan. 75% is going to be the loan. Every year you're going to be guaranteed on the $75,000, and only 25% is an investment. But then it becomes, many Rabbanim, I don't know if you saw the signs, talking about what they call hard money loans, what they it was called in the sign. It wasn't an akuda of the point. But the point was, one of the points of that sign was, if you saw it, and if you didn't say it, was one of the points of the sign was that the many Rabbanim hold, if the profits being generated by this amount of investment is ludicrous to the point of unreasonable, so then it's becomes a chukat lul, becomes a joke. Now, it's to say, well, I gave you $100,000, $99,000 of it is a loan. $1,000 in investment, and you're going to be paying me 500,000% on the one. These investments don't make that. It's a joke. It's you know, if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck. Any other questions? I'm sorry. Okay, so I didn't get into that. Thank you very much. When we write this Heter Iska, which let's for our argument's sake is going to be half a milva and half a bikotin, 50-50. So the question now is, I'm managing the investment. So I'm putting in $50,000 of my loan that I borrowed. And I'm putting in your $50,000 but I'm managing it. Why am I managing your half of the loan, half of the investment? Where's my compensation? So Chazal tells us an amazing idea. And that is as follows. If you don't discuss what my compensation is going to be, then after the fact, you have to compensate me. Tiklin v'charetin. You got to pay me in full what it would normally be, the usual and customary payment for running this investment. However, since prior to the investment, at the time I give you the money, we can make up. your salary for taking care of this will be that you're going to be able to eat French fries at my table, right? Or you could eat. So the Gemara said, generally what we do is we write, and he will be paid $1 as compensation for managing his half of the investment. Because otherwise, there'll be an issue of ribis that you are getting something for nothing that we owned. It sounds like a joke, but listen, I can't argue on the Mishnah. The Gemara says, "Toivel imo bitzir." He could dip his bread in his fish water, and that's sufficient. As long as they made up before what the level of compensation will be.
On the loss, right? For example, a person wipes away, but there is salary involved. Is that considered a loss or not? What's the...
Okay. I'm following, but I'm not following exactly precisely what you want to know. You want to know, let's say we had this business and I was managing the horse business and the price of horses went down.
No, for example, we were breeding horses in the market, right?
And the horses all died.
No, we stayed stable for we pulled out our money, $100,000.
Yes.
After a year, that's it.
Yeah, but everyone's welcome to leave if you want to, because I know everybody has a tight schedule.
It depends basically on, I guess my question and my answer is going to be...
You want to know, is the guy going to get payment for services after he's been wiped out?
Right,
so that's one of the expenses. Pashas, he's entitled to his salary. The only problem is that there may not be funds to pay that salary, depending on who's supposed to be putting in the money.
Exactly. But that's basically on the agreement.
Yeah. Correct. Thank you again.
Shkaya.